Let's turn now to a bunch of, actually, to the last three categories. Let's look at this one first. And this is going to be similar, but actually different to the one we just did a moment ago. I'm not sure. I just couldn't. You mustn't. Just change it.
So there isn't, again, there's a lack of information on there.
Exactly. This is called a simple deletion. So rather than being a deletion or a verb that you haven't got enough information about, the deletion is just generally in the statement. It just doesn't have enough information. Again, these two are very easy to spot just because, as a normal human being, a normal listener, you just listen and go, "What's he talking about?" So you start asking normal questions like, "What are you talking about? What is it about? How can't you run? What aren't you learning?" These are very natural ones to spot. They're very simple to spot. So don't get hung up too much about the labels. Just one is an unspecified verb, the other one's a simple deletion. Let's see if you can get the hang of this one now. This one's pretty interesting. People can enjoy life. You know, it's not safe. Someone's following me. One ought to strive for the best. Have you spotted a pattern there?
So that's a lack of referential index where there's
Ooh.
no. Oh, there we go. Yeah.
Yeah, good man.
The person isn't being specified. It's just a kind of non-specific reference to them.
You're exactly right. So what's happened is you've deleted, you've taken away who's the person doing this stuff, right? So technically it's called you deleted the subject. When you say people can enjoy life, who are people? Who are you talking about? When you're saying it's not safe, well, what isn't safe? When someone's following me, well, who's following you? How do you know what's following you? Who's following you? Right? One ought to do that. Who is one? You, me, who are you talking about? Right? So lack of referential index basically means you are deleting the person that you're referring to. Okay? Let's look at the final category now, and this one should be quite straightforward to get. You know, it's better here. I am worse off now. I'm just more afraid. What's that pattern?
So, I'm better off now, better than when. Lack of information again, so it's, for example, so better here, where is it better than?
Give me an example.
I like soup more.
Perfect.
I don't say more than what.
Exactly. So it's called a comparative deletion. You're basically comparing something, but you're not telling me what it is that you're comparing it to, right? If I say to you, you know, you're a better man. Better than who? Better than what? Better than myself earlier on? Better than another person? You know, I like you better. Better than whom? Right? And this is very important because, of course, this is the place where information gets lost, and we want to get the information back, or sometimes just help people realize that they're making unrealistic comparisons. For example, if someone says, you know, I'm not good enough. Well, again, that should tell you that they're comparing themselves to something, but they're not telling you what. Good enough for what? Well, what are you comparing yourself to? Have some kind of picture inside their mind. You may not even be aware of it, right? A lot of people say think they're not good enough. They don't know what someone that is good enough actually is. So when you ask them, what does it mean to, you know, what are you comparing it to? They'll go, I don't know. So they don't even know what they're comparing themselves to. And then when you start helping them trace what they think they're comparing it to, in other words, what's the unconscious comparison, very often people start realizing, hang on a second, I'm comparing myself to an impossible ideal. No wonder I'm always going to fail at it, right? It's not humanly possible to do that. And this is how people do mess themselves up quite a bit. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Now, with all of these patterns, they basically people are deleting information or distorting it or generalizing it. Basically, they're changing, remember we talked about this in the first session, the filters that allow information into them, they're changing them in such a way that they create limitations or blocks or walls around themselves where they get stuck. So your job as an NLP practitioner or as a therapist or just a decent human being is to challenge these metamodel violations to help them do one of two things. Either to make them help them realize that they're making a stupid comparison or that, you know, they have unrealistic expectations in some sense, so that they can drop the unrealistic parts of it and end up just, you know, enjoying life again. Or you're recovering information, and in recovering information, like I'm just not good enough, by recovering information, you start finding out what the real problem is, and then you can really go down to working what's the real causes, the real problem is, rather than what people think the problem is. Does it make sense?
Yeah, it does.
So let's turn our attention then to doing exactly that. We have our categories, and for each category, there's a certain kind of challenge that will help you to cover the information that's lost, to find out the very thing that the person's not telling you. And if nothing else, to really to remind them that they might be making a kind of a logical, that their thinking isn't very logical in what they're doing. Now, I know, Sean, that you like, for example, CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. So the meta model, in many ways, is cognitive behavioral therapy because you're doing the same thing that you're doing in CBD, but it's a much more simplified, a much more elegant model, in my opinion. And I think it's been around for a bit longer as well, so it's actually quite a useful model to think about. Now, we're going to go through a bunch of challenges that will allow you to basically challenge people when they get stuck with a meta-model violation, like the examples we gave you. And I'm going to do two things at the end. We're going to find out a way of simplifying all the challenges, and we're going to find out... So let's start with the cause-effect. Do you remember what a cause-effect was, Sean?
Yeah, one thing causes another.
Give me an example.
So, my boss makes me feel bad.
So how might you challenge that so the person realizes that they're doing it, it's not something that's happening outside of themselves?
How does your boss make you feel bad?
Okay, so now you can recovering behavior. So rather than deleting the behavior, you're actually getting to specific behavior, and then you might be able to challenge at that level. The other way you can do it is actually to remind them that they're at effect, that they're at the cause, that they're the ones that are allowing this to happen. And you might ask them, like, how does boss cause you to allow yourself to feel bad or inferior or whatever? Make sense?
Yeah, okay, yeah.
So there are two, you're absolutely right, your version, there's basically two ways that you can challenge. One is just purely to find the, you know, behavioral, the sensory information. The second is to bring them back to being responsible for their own lives and realizing that they're the ones who are responsible for their emotions, the way they feel, etc. And both have equal merit, by the way. They just give you different types of information. So I'm going to go through some of the examples that I gave you earlier on, and you get to challenge me. I'll be coming in with a problem, you challenge me, and I'll give you an answer like a person might. Okay?
Sure.
You make me feel bad, Sean.
How do I make you feel bad, Igor?
So, and to get to sensory information, you might say something like, well, what specifically am I doing that is causing you to allow yourself to feel bad or to choose to feel bad? Because what you're doing there is it's a very, very subtle presupposition that I'm the one who's doing it to myself, right? Mm-hmm. After all,
right.
I'm the one who's feeling bad. It's happening inside of me. It's my neurology doing the work, right? You're just providing you just happen to be providing the stimulus. Let's try it again on the next one. Because you didn't get that last one, Sean, it means you're no good. So use that as a cause effect on the complex equivalent.
Okay, so how does me not doing very well on the last one mean I'm bad, Igor?
Excellent. So you now have challenged the complex equivalent, so that was my mistake for giving an ambiguous one. Let's do another one. I can't go to the restaurant now because you didn't do your work properly, Sean.
So why does the fact that I didn't do my work properly mean that you aren't going to allow yourself to go to the restaurant?
Perfect. Now, you, as a rule of thumb, NLP people try and avoid the question why, because people give excuses with why. When you ask how, you get more sensory-based information, you get behavioral information. Do you see the difference?
Yeah, sure.
And having said that, I'm not a big believer in the why taboo. There's a lot of NLP people who've got a taboo about why. Just understand that asking a why question and asking a how question gives you a different type of information, and that more often a how question is more useful in terms of the information you get, because you get basically behavioral or procedural information, whereas with a why question you tend to get more excuses and reasons. Make sense?
Yeah, it does, yeah.
Let's try another one. He's so stupid because he's too tall.
How does him being tall make you think he's stupid?
Just is, right? So excellent. So you've got the complex, the cause-effect now. Let's try some cause-effects instead. You're late. You really don't care about me.
Sorry, am I challenging this, Igor?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. how does the fact that I'm late make you feel that I don't care about you?
Or make it even straightforward, how does that the fact that I'm late mean that I don't care? How the hell can you equate the two?
Right, yeah.
You know, there's a ding in your car, it means you have to sell it now.
How does the fact there's a ding in my car mean that I have to sell it now?
Exactly. Well, what does a ding in my car have to do with selling it? Forget it, right? You're drunk, you're lying to me.
How does me being drunk mean that I'm lying to you?
Perfect. So you caught the implied meaning there. So I haven't said it, I've deleted it, but it still implies it in the construction. Let's try another construction. He doesn't like me.
How do you know?
Perfect. It's exactly the right challenge. Okay. Notice, by the way, how, just understanding the nature of presuppositions, you're actually coming up with all the correct metamodal challenges spontaneously. Right? This is the key thing. If you look into your manual under the heading the metamodal table, you'll find in the index, you will find a little table with the metamodal, an example of the metamodal, an example of the challenges you can do to get the information back, right? And a lot of people try and memorize these questions, and there's no point, because if you understand the idea of presuppositions, then you'll understand at what level you get to challenge, because you'll understand what the presupposition is in the sentence that makes a problem. So you just basically challenge that presupposition, and by challenging it, you come up with the right verbal formula, so to speak. Now, let's try another category. You know, people like you never amount to much, Sean. Did you know that?
So who says?
Perfect. Or? Beautiful. Exactly. Says who? It's a lost performative. Like, says who? How do you know? What are you talking about? You can't drop out and expect to succeed.
Says who?
Perfect. Right? See, again, right, you're challenging the fact that someone's made a valid statement, the performer, but we're not saying who it is. Let's see if you can spot this one. You have to listen to me, Sean. This is an interesting challenge here.
My natural implication is to say, why do I have to listen to you?
Now, let's stay clear of why for the moment, just for the same reasons, yeah. Because although why this can help, there is a very interesting challenge you can throw out, which gets some very interesting information back.
So what will me listening to you achieve?
Excellent. There's one version. Now let's turn that, use your negation ideas and see if you can turn that into a negative and see where my attention isn't.
So if I don't listen to you, what will happen?
Perfect. Right? What would happen if I didn't? What?
Right, yeah.
Right? So basically, I'm implying a modal operator necessity that the basic presupposition there is that there is only one path. This is the one. And I deleted all other paths because the consequences are too horrible to imagine. Which means they're probably not imagining them, right? Which means that if they did imagine them, they might be not quite so horrible as they thought they were, and maybe there is another possibility after all. So that maybe you don't have to do this version, you might be able to get away with other versions. Do you see the logic behind that?
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
You really should do it right the first time, Sean.
What would happen if I didn't do it right the first time?
Well, you'd have to do it again, Sean. do you see what it is? Because it sounds so terrible, what I'm saying. Like, you have to get it right the first time. But when you challenge, like, well, it's not that big a deal, so I do it again. So what? What's the big deal? Right?
Right, yeah.
And this is exactly the beauty of the metamodal pattern, because people don't realize that they're trapping themselves in exactly this way. It's doing really good, by the way. Let's move on to the next pattern, the next category. Sean, you just can't do that.
What about if I did do that?
Perfect, right? You're just basically taking the same idea in the modal operative necessity and you're switching it around. You can't do that. Well, what would happen if I did? Well, nothing, I guess. But, I don't know, it just feels wrong. You see what I mean? You're asking for consequences now. There's another challenge you can do on modal operators of possibility. Usually, when applied to self, and this is a particularly important pattern, like, you know, I just can't stop smoking. So there's another way you can challenge that. What do you think that might be?
What is it that stops you from giving
up
smoking?
That's exactly it. So what prevents you? So the implication in that statement is that there is a barrier, prevention of some sort. So you can either get more information, so you know what is the barrier, and that you can work at the level of the barrier, or you actually blow out the problem and suddenly you realize that there is no barrier. Oh, I don't know. Maybe I can do it. So either you get more information, so you've got something to work with, or you solve the problem. Either way is better. Got that one?
Yeah, sure.
So remember, possibility, you have two simple challenges. What would happen if you did? In other words, you're recovering a negative choice. And what prevents you if they perceive themselves to be impossible to do something? Let's try this one. You know, you're always criticizing me.
Always.
Yeah, so you get exactly right. So I guess you, what? Always.
Yeah,
Yeah.
sorry, that was a bit, yeah, I was trying to
Well,
question that, yeah.
you mean there's not ever been a time when I haven't criticized you? Yeah. You mean, well, what about last Tuesday when I said that your shoes are really nice? Oh, well, that doesn't count. Right? So you just bust the universality of the universal quantifier.
Right, yeah.
Right? I can never get it right.
You can never get it right.
Never ever. No, never.
So what about when you
Exactly.
did get it right?
So you have basically three levels of intervention on universal qualifiers. One is implied doubt. What? Never. You mean you've never got it right, not even once? You know, I can never. I'm a terrible speller. I always spell things wrong. Like, you always spell things wrong. You haven't written a single word correctly in your entire life. That is some achievement, right? And I have to say, no, you know, I have spelled some words right, but like the big words, I can't get the big words. So now you get more information, and you basically what you're doing is you're taking this thing that looks like a huge problem in my mind, and you're chunking it down to something smaller and therefore more manageable, right? The second intervention is a counterexample. It does the same sort of thing. The counterexample is basically pointing out to them that there are times when they have done it, which means that their statement is too broad. So part of the reason that people get scared themselves of universal quantifiers is because they're saying it's the whole world, it's everything, it's the same time. The whole world's against me. They look like, the whole world? What about Mr. So-and-so who lives next door? He kind of likes you. Yeah, but he doesn't count. Oh, okay. So it's the whole world minus Mr. So-and-so who doesn't like you. Well, yeah. And again, do you see how that begins to make people feel a bit sheepish about their statements because they kind of overreacted the whole time? See how that works?
Yeah, sure.
The final version is, again, you can play with some of the necessity possibility ideas implied with it. I can never get it right. There's a kind of an impossibility implied. And you can always ask, like, you know, what would happen if you did get it right? So that's another version. But to be staying on the same logical level as the presupposition, you're basically going to either cast doubt on the always, you're going to give them a counterexample so that they clearly can see that there is a, you know, it's a more limited problem than they actually thought it was. Right?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm depressed. No, I have depression in my life and a lot of anxiety too.
How much anxiety do you have in your life?
A lot.
And how do
Remember,
you,
this
sorry.
is what is the basic pattern?
It's a normalization,
Exactly.
so
So what's the problem with the normalization?
that it's really a verb discloses a noun.
Exactly. So what is the challenge then? The challenge is to turn it back into a verb again, to make it flow freely again. It's kind of like someone's taken a little kid that's running around, and he's just put him in the freezer and flash frozen him, and the kid's frozen, right? So you have to
Right.
unfreeze him again so you can see what this kid does, so you can actually work with something, because whilst he's frozen, you have nothing to work with, right? You can't help a kid run better when he's frozen in a running pose. You have to thaw him out and then get the angles all right and motivate him and do whatever. So I have a lot of depression and a lot of anxiety in my life.
So, how are you being depressed? No.
That's good. Actually, that's the right kind of idea. Only that you've still disempowered me because if you say, how are you being depressed, you're implying that someone else is doing it to me rather than allowing me to recover full choice, which is mean something I'm really doing. So, how are you depressing yourself? What are you doing to depress yourself?
Right, okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Or, I have a lot of anxiety in my life.
So how are you dieting yourself? How are you?
Just say it naturally. How do you make yourself feel so anxious? What do you
Right,
do?
yeah.
right? Just always think about in the back of your mind, what did you do? What did you do to make that happen? How do you do that? It's basically the question. How do you do that? Right?
Okay.
How do you do that? How are you making yourself anxious? How are you making yourself feel depressed? So just try this one out. And this is, by the way, this is taking it to a more regular context where, you know, again, people use normalizations to limit you and other people around them. You know, my decision is final. Of course, what's the implication there? There's no change. It's impossible to change because it's a thing now. My decision is final.
So how are you deciding that's final?
Yeah, how do you decide that? What were you doing decide that? So now you're taking the decision back into a process, and a process is always changing. So you have a chance to change a decision. A little story on this. One of the people I used to coach in a big blue chip corporate selling to a big client, and the client basically would refuse to speak to him because they basically rejected the order, refused to speak to him. He could only speak through the secretary, and the secretary said, she made up her mind, decision's final, we're not buying it. So he sent her a one-line email, basically denormalizing on decision, and added a nice little thing at the end as well that made her curious. The girl got straight onto the phone, called him up, said, I see your point, and he had no idea what the point was, but she saw it anyway. And they got into a little 10-15 minute chat, at the end of which, of course, she bought everything. So she ended up stocking up with his thing rather than a competing product. So normalizations or denormalizing normalizations can be very powerful. Let's try this one. I'm afraid.
How are you afraid?
Yeah. So how are you doing that? How are you doing fear? I hurt.
How do you hurt?
Yeah. And the other one you can do is how do you know? I'm afraid. How do you know? I run.
So how are you running?
Yeah. The word to use here, just as a NLP people like this, is specifically. So how specifically are you doing that? So specifically implies give me more information. You know, I run. How do you do that? Well, I put foot in front of the other and I run. But it doesn't give you much more information. So how specifically are you doing that? Well, I am engaging my hips and moving this and that, and I'm getting much more information back as a result. Let's try this. You know, it's not safe.
What specifically is not safe?
Exactly. Well, stop it.
Stop what?
Yeah. What are you talking about? Specifically, what am I meant to be stopping? You know, people are damned to hell and suffering.
What people?
Yeah, which one are you talking about? And of course, it also happens to be a lost performative, so you can also say, says who? Say, notice again how one statement has several violations built into it at the same time, so you can challenge on different things. You know, I'm a lot worse off now.
You're a lot worse off than when?
Someone that was really rich. Okay, I'm just more afraid.
You're more afraid than what?
I'm just more afraid than I was this morning when I had my happy pill. Good. So you understand the meta model and you understand how to challenge it, right?
Yeah, I like that a lot actually, yeah.
And you understand the value of challenging it.
Yeah.
So this is a very elegant model for causing change. It's also a great way of creating sort of doubt in people's minds about things. So they were so sure about their problem and then starts getting a little bit of doubt. Like, am I really that afraid? What is it I'm afraid of? And as soon as they start thinking, one of the things that happens is that you're kind of loosening up the concrete inside their mind. Problems tend to be these fixed, hard things. And your job is to come in with like an ice pick and start chopping it all up. So it's kind of free-flowing again. And when it starts having this free-flowing mush, the ice can start melting. Eventually, it'll turn back to water more easily, right? And you want it to flow freely. You want it to be like water. And one of the jobs that the meta model challenge, is to crack up the ice and start, you know, breaking up the concrete, so it starts loosening things up, so you've got something to work with and you can start moving it about again. It allows you to create movement. The next thing it does is, if you really stick at these questions and really hold people true to them, you can literally blow out problems with this just by itself. Like, he hates me, how do you know? Well, he looks at me in that kind of thing that tells me that always means he's angry. You mean he's never looked that way and not been angry? No. Well, how do you know? Well, I guess I don't know. So how else might he be? Well, maybe he's just being thoughtful or whatever, right? So now they start working their own way out of the problem. The third thing that it does is that it allows you to recover information, right? He hates me. How do you know? Because he looks at me that way, or because he doesn't talk to me, right? Notice this big difference between he doesn't talk to me and he looks at me in a certain way. Perhaps if he doesn't talk to me, it's just because he's busy. Maybe he doesn't hate you, he's just busy, right? It's a completely different thing. And you might go down the road of saying, you see that look on their face and yada yada, and they're going, what look? I can't see him, that's the problem, he's not there. So this helps you as a hypnotist find out what is the induction going to be about in the first place? What is the raw materials you have to work with? As an NLP practitioner, it helps you find out what is the real problems, and again, what are the raw materials you have to work with? If it's a look on someone's face, you might, when we come to techniques, you'll find out more. You might choose to do a simple swish technique, where you just make the look on the face makes them feel good instead, right? It might be an anchoring technique on the look of the face. If it's a question of them not talking to you, may choose to use a reframe instead or something similar. So do you see how it does three very important functions in the metamodel? It gives you more information, so you have more to work with, it's more real stuff to work with. It allows them to start seeing how silly they've been, so that the problem is not such a big deal anymore, and often it just blows the problem out entirely. And it allows you to start loosening up the concrete and start, breaking down the ice. So that things can start flowing freely again, and when you start doing suggestions, you start using the techniques, which are basically a form of suggestion, that these things have something to attach to. They don't just bounce off this ice shield, which is this whole, petrified forest inside their mind. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Now I'm going to give you a warning. Do you know what a meta monster is?
No, I don't.
Specifically, don't you know?
What a meta monster is.
And how do you know you don't know that?
I'm now thinking I get what a meta monster is.
Okay, so people, when they come across metamodel, things as the greatest thing, and then they think they're helping their friends and family by just standing there and brutalizing them with challenge after challenge after challenge until they say, you know what, enough already, just leave me the hell alone, right? Now, if you're using the meta model, you need to use it again in a normal context. If you're a coach or a therapist, you have much more leeway to rattle people's cages, because that's what they've come to you for, than if you are just sitting with your friends and family around the dinner table, right? So don't start annoying the hell out of people just because you can. Of course, if that's what you want to do, then the meta model is a great tool to, how to lose friends and alienate people. Just use the meta model, right? Second thing to realize is that if you are going to use a meta model, you may want to soften your challenges because they can be very hard. How do you know? What makes you say that? How do you know you make yourself feel this way? What would happen if you didn't? Right? Do you see this is like the FBI interview? You just imagine someone coming up with a lantern and shining in your face to get half blinded, and they're saying, "We have ways of finding out. How are you deciding that now?" Right? You don't want to do this. You don't want to put people under that kind of negative pressure. Pressure might be good, but you can soften and say, I'm curious about that. So how are you deciding that? Right? Or says, he hates me, he goes, oh, okay. Just help me out here. How do you know that he helps you? Oh, it's dangerous to leave your safely paid job. Okay, just out of curiosity, how do you know? Who said that? See how you can soften the frame and you get to pick your battles. You get to choose context in which it's appropriate to challenge on meta model violations. Does this make sense to you?
Yeah, it does, yeah.
So, do you have any questions for me so far, Mr. Sean?
No, I don't think I do, but I like that a lot, so I'm going to really drill into that and start using it more with my clients.
Perfect. The best way to get good at this is to start using it. Again, look in your notes under the heading meta model table. You might maybe just be able to print that out and just carry that sheet around with you. It's got all the meta model patterns, all the examples of what it means, and a challenge, so you have them all neatly lined up for you to use. And by the way, if you want to simplify the meta models to two questions, the two questions are what specifically or which XXX specifically. and how specifically? Too many cooks spoil the broth. Well, which cooks specifically are you talking about, right? How specifically do they spoil the broth? You know, he hates me. Well, how specifically does he hate you? And how do you know that? You just remember those two questions. It allows you entrance into any one of those challenges. So there's like that's the meta model light, if you like. Make sense?
Yeah, sure. The only thing I was going to ask you was, I've heard you say before about meta model 1, meta model 3. And
yeah, exactly. Okay.
Is there differences then?
That's actually a very good question. What we just covered is meta model 1. It's the basic meta model. It's actually a specific way of using the meta model to acquire deep information. It's basically the meta model just used with a little bit more alacrity. Meta model 3 is a way of using your questions in order to basically target a problem and blow through it more clearly and then get resources. So you basically ask a bunch of questions and they go from problem, losing problem, having resources, feeling great again. Basically using questions rather than just to get more information, loosen up the concrete and possibly blow out the problem, using questions to do all those things and above all else, find resources and blow through the problem. So if you listen to the Mind Bending Language Masterclass, it's a bit more of an advanced idea. All the questions we were asking there, examples of Meta Model 3, because they go beyond the scope of just simple violations. They start basically challenging the mind to go to places it doesn't normally go to, and then find novel solutions, novel resources, and basically overcome problems that way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Okay, that's a good question. So let's turn, finally, our attention to the Milton model. Now, if you recall, in the first session, we talked about how Grin and Bandler spent all this time studying Fritz Perls and Virginia Satir, and they came up with this wonderful meta model that we've just spent a lot of time looking at. And they go, wow, this is it. This is the nuts. We use this thing, and we'll help people make better. And if all therapists know this, they'll be better therapists. Basically, the secret key to life and therapy and everything is ask really, really good questions, make people get really, really precise in their thinking, and that blows up problems. Great, we've done it. So then they go and show this thing, their thesis to a man called Gregory Bateson, a great anthropologist, and a great intellectual as well. And he was very impressed by this. In fact, he said he wished that he had come up with this idea himself when he had done a similar project, but had to give it up because he didn't really get as good a result. And then he sat back and he started thinking and he said, you know, boys, you think that you've cracked the secret to life and everything by just getting more and more specific and detailed in the way you ask questions. You know, I know a guy who will turn all your theories on his head because he gets amazing results. Only he does everything you'd say people shouldn't. He is so vague, no one seems to know what he's talking about, but people still get better. Now, of course, at this point, Grinder and Bandler's ears perk up. The man they were talking about, of course, was Milton Erickson. And when they finally got around to seeing Milton Erickson and review his videotapes and transcripts, etc., they used the same model to try and analyze what Milton Erickson was doing. And sure enough, they found that whilst other therapists like Fritz Perls and Virginia Satir were using really good questions to break through this vague, fuzzy thinking that were the metamodal violations, Milton Erickson would revel in these violations. He would use them, but he would use them with such exquisite elegance that people would be dropping into trances like flies, and they would have like these amazing, miraculous cures. So they start asking, how is he doing this? Now, the way it turns out is that all the distortions that we talked about, all the violations, the cause-effect, the complex scrim, the mind-read, etc., one of the reasons that people have problems when they think in these ways is because these are hypnotic language constructions. So they're basically hypnotizing themselves to have the problem. When someone thinks, she's afraid of me, or he doesn't like me, that is a hypnotic suggestion they've created. And by challenging it, what Grinder and Bandler were doing, they were actually breaking through the hypnosis filter by getting people to realize that there is no substance to that suggestion that they gave themselves. That make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Now, what Milton Erickson was doing, on the other hand, and this is sheer genius, is he wasn't actually bothering with getting more precise questions to blow through so people saw the illusion or the suggestion they were giving themselves. He would actually take the same patterns. Rather than putting in negative suggestions, he would take out the negative elements and just load them up with positive suggestions. So instead of thinking he's afraid of me, how about having a positive suggestion? He loves you. And he looks at you in that way, and you know he loves you. And because he loves you can feel $1 million. So suddenly, we have a man that's taken all the violations and changed the content from something that's negative, problematic, to something that's positive and makes people feel better and releases them. The Milton model was born. Now, it turns out that Milton Erickson actually was using more than just the patterns that we've talked about so far in the meta model. So Milton Erickson, actually, the Milton model actually includes a whole bunch of other patterns as well. So what is the Milton model patterns? Well, the Milton model pattern is exactly the same as the meta model, only this time you're going to take all those negative examples I gave you and you're going to put something positive in its place. I'm going to do an exercise in a moment. Before we do that, though, I want to add a couple of additional patterns that aren't talked about in the meta model. So remember, the last example of a meta model violation we had was the comparative deletion. It's better here, I'm worse off now, I'm more afraid. Now, is better here is an example of a positive hypnotic language pattern because you're orienting someone's mind towards something positive. I'm worse off now is, of course, a negative hypnotic language pattern in the sense that it makes people feel worse about themselves. The other language patterns that are in the Milton model start with tag questions. Tag questions that you add at the end of a statement to kind of elicit a kind of response from someone. It's usually like a yes response. You understand what I mean by that, don't you? Now, you can imagine talking to someone and getting involved, can't you? And I mean, you don't have to do anything in particular. You just, talk to people, and when you say something, it can be very spontaneous. And you've been spontaneous in the past, haven't you? So do you see example of how tag questions work at the end?
Yeah.
Now, tag questions work on a couple of different levels. Here's the theory anyway. I don't think anyone's actually proven this theory, but it's a nice theory. We know that they work. The idea of why they work is following. Number one, you kind of create a yes ladder, a yes ladder. You're getting people to mentally kind of agree with you, give them a little shot in the arm where they're going, yeah, he's right. Oh, yeah, he's right. Oh, yeah, he's right. So you're kind of eliciting a response from them where they're going, nope, this guy's right. The other way it can work is when you have someone called a polar responder, someone who needs to disagree with something. Because tag questions are usually phrased in a negative, don't you, can't you, haven't you, isn't that right? Yeah? They have a slight negative twist to them, which can often satisfy people who've got a slight tendency to be, negative and say, well, this isn't, you say black, I'll say white. It has a tendency to satisfy them because the question has been reversed, it has a negative within it. I don't know how true that is. All I do know is that I've used it very successfully with polar responders. I've used it very successfully in other places. And I'm sure you can imagine using it in all kinds of places in your own hypnotic language, couldn't you?
Yes, I can.
Very good. The next pattern is called basically pacing current experience. This is a very famous part of the Milton model that almost every hypnotic induction currently in existence is using. And the idea of this is basically to create a kind of a yes ladder again, where you're basically following step by step what experience someone's having, because and then you attach at the end of that some experience you want them to have but they don't know about yet. For example, everyone who's listening to this recording right now can hear the sound of my voice. You're probably in a certain environment. Maybe it's in a room or maybe it's outside. You may be sitting, standing, or lying down. You're gonna have your eyes open or your eyes closed. And because you're doing this, you really get a chance to experience and learn the full power and impact of the hypnotic process. So notice what I've done here is I've said a whole bunch of things that are going to be in your experience. You have to be either inside somewhere or outside of somewhere. There's no other option. Your eyes will be either open or they'll be closed. There's very little other option. If you can hear me, then you're listening to me. Otherwise, I could be speaking anyway and it makes no difference to you whatsoever. So if you're understanding what I'm saying, then you must be listening to me. You are either sitting, standing, or lying down, or maybe you're walking, I guess is the other version I've used. So basically, I'm pacing your experience, even though I don't even know what your experience is. Imagine if you're in front of someone, how much easier it is. You can see them sitting, you can see them breathing, you can see them blinking, you can see them shifting color, you can see them looking up and down and across, you can hear them answering, you can see them listening to you. So you can use all these things. Now, one of the beauties of the pacing current experience is, when combined presuppositions of awareness, you can take people's attention towards an experience and pace it at the same time. It's kind of like a pace and a lead combined. Notice the sensation of your right foot, right? So, assuming you have got a right foot, I've taken your awareness there. So it's pacing the experience because your awareness is there and you're noticing it. But at the same time, it's a lead because I've taken your awareness there at the same time. So you have a lot of scope with this pattern, pacing current experience. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Okay. Conversational postured. It's basically a question that really doesn't require an answer. It is actually asking for you to do something. Like, you could close that door, couldn't you? I'm asking you whether or not you can close the door, but I don't really care whether or not you're closing that can close the door. What I want you to do is actually an instruction to close the door, right? Would it be possible for you to close your eyes? Well, technically the answer is yes or no, but it's understood and accepted as an instruction. So it's a way of softening an instruction so it's less invasive, and hence, particularly in a lot of Western societies like the United States of America and Britain, where people are a little bit more softly spoken, that you don't trigger a reaction like, you can't tell me what to do. Of course, in other societies, for example, Scandinavian societies, people are quite happy to be very blunt and direct and say, close your eyes, and it's quite acceptable. So conversational postulates work particularly well in these, so we say, slightly softer or more softly spoken societies. Next, we talk about double binds. We talked about binds and double binds already in the presuppositions, right? Would you like to go into a deep trance right now, or would you prefer to go into hypnosis at your own rate and pace in a few moments? So either way, you're going to go into hypnosis, whether it's deep and right now, or whether it's going to be at your own rate, or in a moment's time, it doesn't matter, it's going to happen. The next pattern in the Milton model is called extended quotes. Basically, you're going to start quoting other people. For example, Erickson will always say to people, it's the easiest thing in the world to use extended quote. Like my friend John will turn around to me and say, if you just close your eyes and go into hypnosis, you can find yourself drifting. So notice that in that example, I gave you two set of extended quotes. One was Milton Erickson saying something that I wanted you to know, and another one was someone else in Erickson's quotes telling him something that I want you to experience. So extended quotes are a great way. Grin and Bandler used to amuse themselves no end by using extended quotes to insult their audience. Particularly, they had a lot of psychiatrists and psychologists there who they had didn't view very favorably. And so they'd, you know, stand on the stage and they'd tell a story about being on a turkey farm. And then they'd stand on the stage and point at the audience and go, "Hey, you turkeys, come over here!" Right? So it's basically they're standing there and using it as an excuse to insult people. It's a little bit childish, in my opinion, but they enjoy themselves. Extended quotes, very usefully, to distance yourself from a suggestion that you're not quite sure how it'll be taken. And it'll also be a nice way of being more indirect about suggestions. So do you understand those ones? The postulates, the double binds, and the extended quotes?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, now we're going to come on to a tricky set of language patterns called ambiguities. Ambiguity is basically the English language, and actually as most languages, has all kinds of gray areas. When I say, for example, when we use the presupposition, I must stop beating my son, right? You thought that I was talking about hitting him and, you know, being violent towards him. Whereas in my mind, I was thought about playing games with him and maybe considering whether it'd be more character building to let him win a few games, or it's more character building to just, you know, make him win his own games. That's an example of a chronological ambiguity. Actually, no, it's not chronological. This is kind of scope ambiguity. We're not sure of the scope. What are we talking about? Who is beating in the sense of, you know, being violent, in the sense of this? Which one are we talking about? In order to make sense of that statement, the unconscious mind will actually listen to, or activate both varieties, then choose the most likely one given the context for you to understand consciously. However, you can use the other version unconsciously. So for example, I could say to you, you know, I don't know if I should stop beating my son at chess. Now, as a unconscious instruction, that could also be to stop beating, for example, stop beating something else. So ambiguities come in basically four types. We have phonological, which are also known as homonyms, when two things sound the same, right? Hear now what I'm saying. So you can say, hear now where I am, or hear now what I'm saying. The same word here and here sounds identical in English. You can't distinguish it unless you get the context. And you can use the phonological ambiguities to make people think one thing and then end up going into something else. It's called a punctuational ambiguity. And the punctuational ambiguity is called a run-on sentence, where you use things like a phonological ambiguity to make people think you're saying one thing, and then suddenly you reverse the process. The classic example is, you know, you really should use your head right into trance now. So notice how use your head is one idea, and head right into trance now is another idea. So just as you're thinking, oh, he's talking about I should use my head, I should think a little bit more, I suddenly switch the meaning on you. Your mind has to scramble to catch up. In that scramble, you create a lovely little doorway into hypnosis. Do those two ambiguities make sense so far?
Yeah, they do.
The next couple are called syntactic ambiguity and scope ambiguity. In a syntactical ambiguity, you're not quite sure what you mean immediately. The classic example is, hypnotizing hypnotists can be tricky. What am I saying when I say that? What do I mean by that?
I'm not sure, really.
Hypnotizing hypnotists can be tricky. Are the hypnotists tricky, or is it tricky to hypnotize them?
Yeah, sort of a double meaning there, depending on...
Exactly. So there's, again, the ambiguity, and the double meaning is due to the syntax. It's not quite sure. The sentence makes sense either way perfectly well, right? Finally, we have the idea of a scope ambiguity. In this one, we're not clear of how far the speaker means to go. For example, speaking to you right now is someone interested in hypnosis. I'd like you to know that, yada, yada, yada. Now, am I speaking to you and you're the one who's interested in hypnosis? Or am I the one who's interested in hypnosis and I'm speaking to you from that place? Which is it? Right? So the scope, again, is not clear. It's kind of similar to syntactic ambiguity, but different in that regard. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, yeah.
Ambiguities are a beautiful territory for hypnotic language to work in. And in particular, because you can basically, it's the basis of multi-level communication. You can communicate with the conscious mind and the unconscious mind simultaneously in different ways. So you can make them think of a one statement at the conscious level, whilst you give them a separate set of instructions to the unconscious mind, all based on ambiguities. A classic one that NLP people like to bandy about, and you know, you're welcome to it, I'll give it to you in a moment. I think it's a little overused, of course, is when people talk about, you know, say a product or whatever now, and you might say something like, by now you're probably wondering how much this product costs, right? Of course, by now is an example of a scope ambiguity. It's an instruction, by now I'm waving around my card or my CD or whatever it is I want to buy, and it's an unconscious instruction to buy it now. At the same time, consciously they hear, buy now, B-Y, now. You're thinking about, you know, how much this thing might cost. Or by now you might be considering, you know, going on holiday or whatever the sentence might be. So you have two totally different meanings, one at the conscious level and one at the unconscious level. Ambiguities are probably the most elegant way of achieving that. Does the Milton model make sense to you?
Yep.